Winter stood in the operations room, her jaw clenched, her eyes narrowed, as she viewed the progress of the assault transports on the monitor. They had reached her first line of defenses. When Admiral Ackbar and Luke Skywalker established the Anoth hiding place, they had been unwilling to rely entirely on secrecy. They had tried to plan for every possible attack scenario. Winter looked down at her status panels. The Foreign Intruder Defense Organism was primed and ready for automatic strike. She anticipated that Fido could take out at least two of the spider walkers. Scuttling up the rock wall with insectile legs, the spider walkers reached a line of caves, small openings to a labyrinth of dead ends and grottos within the stone. The uppermost assault walker paused and fired a preemptive strike against the blast doors above with two forward lasers. As the second spider walker also prepared to fire, masses of whip-like tentacles, long ropes, each ending in a razor-sharp pincer claw, lashed out of the hidden caves. Two of Fido's writhing arms locked around the first walker and ripped it from the cliff face. Before the machine could use its pneumatic claws to grasp the rock again, Fido tossed the spider walker over the edge. Winter watched as Fido destroyed three more spider walkers, as still more approached. Then, at close range, one stormtrooper pilot powered up his blaster cannons and fired into the caves. The enormous explosion ripped out a vast chunk of the catacombed understructure. Flames and dust, broken rocks, and volatile gases sprayed in a plume that rose into the violet skies of Anoth. The backwash vaporized Fido's body core and simultaneously detonated the captured spider walker. Inside the operations room, Fido's diagnostic panel went blank. The multi-legged assault transports began pounding against the blast doors. Winter knew what she had to do. She ran along the tunnels, leaving the metal hatches open for escape once the stormtrooper saw her. When she emerged into the landing grotto, the explosions from outside nearly deafened her. The blast doors buckled inward. Articulated claws pushed through the opening. Laser strikes continued around the attachment bolts until the left side door twisted. The other door hung askew in its track. Whistling wind shrieked into the landing grotto as Winter stood ready to face the assault. Four huge mechanical assault transports picked their way over the wreckage and halted with hissing engines in the middle of the grotto. Winter took a quick inventory. Each of the four spider walkers carried two troopers, eight targets. She fired off three shots in quick succession. The nearest soldier flew backward with his white armor blasted to pieces. Other soldiers boiled out of the transports, firing in her direction. Winter hunched down but could not get another shot in. The last spider walker opened up to reveal one stormtrooper and a squat man with huge eyebrows and thick lips. The other troopers had pinpointed Winter's position and hammered repeated blasts at her. She backed toward the open hatch. Winter had two choices. She could either run back and defend Anakin with her life, or she could lure the seven remaining invaders away from the baby and do her best to dispose of them. The squat man screamed from his hiding place under the spider walker.
Don't kill her! You stun until you have the child! You!
He gestured to the trooper who had emerged from the spider walker with him.
Come with me. The rest of you, capture that woman!
Exactly as Winter had hoped. She sped along the sloping tunnels, ducking low through jagged archways, slamming heavy airlock doors behind her as she passed into a deeper level of the installation. The stormtroopers made short work of the thick hatches with thermal detonators. Winter led them through the labyrinth of passages until she succeeded in luring them into the subterranean generator room and computer core. The chamber itself was a dim morass of tangled equipment, cooling ducts, metal pipes, and throbbing life support systems. The computer core glowed with oblong green lights that flickered in a waterfall pattern. Winter knew the equipment was just stage dressing to hide the real purpose of the chamber. The troopers hesitated at the threshold as if suspecting a trap. Winter pointed her blaster and fired seven rapid shots at them. The stormtroopers dove for cover, and then, when Winter did not fire again, charged into the dim room after her. The Imperials got halfway across the space before the walls began to writhe and move. Jointed pipelines and conduits, bulky control decks, and spherical readout panels shifted, clicking together into specific components. The machine-filled wall suddenly became a squad of burly assassin droids assembled out of disguised components. The droids activated their weapons, forming a shooting gallery whose only purpose was to destroy. None of the stormtroopers had an opportunity to fire a single shot. Ambassador Fergan crouched low as the stormtrooper sprinted ahead of him down the lumpy rock corridors. They passed door after door, unsealing each room. They found storage compartments, the dining room, empty sleeping quarters, but no child. Finally, one door ground open, exposing the pastel colors of a room filled with toys, a plush bed, and a four-armed nanny droid backed into a protective position in the corner to shelter a small child.
"Ah, here we are at last," Fergan said.
He stepped inside, looking around for booby traps. The trooper flanked him, maintaining his defensive position, blaster rifle in hand. Fergan saw no other defenses, just the TDL droid.
"Please leave," said the nanny droid. "You are disturbing the baby."
Fergan let loose with a full-throated laugh.
"The only defense they managed was one nanny droid."
The droid stood in front of the baby, who sat very still on the floor. She used her lower set of arms to unfold a blaster-proof metal apron from the base of her torso to shield the baby from stray laser fire.
"You may not have this child."
"How touching."
Fergan nodded to the stormtrooper.
"Go get the baby."
The stormtrooper took one step forward. All four of the droid's hands detached and dropped to the floor, exposing the blaster barrels hidden in each of her wrists.
"I am an enhanced nanny droid, and you will not harm this child."
She let loose with all four barrels. The four beams struck the approaching stormtrooper before he could swing up his blaster rifle. Fergan ducked, but continued to fire. The nanny droid centered all four blaster arms on him, but he raked his stream of blaster bolts across her rounded head and soft flesh-encased torso. Sparks flew, and molten metal showered in all directions. Beneath the blaster-proof apron, the baby began to wail. Fergan stepped over the debris of the nanny droid and the dead stormtrooper. He reached down to grab one of little Anakin's arms and yanked him into the air by the cloth of his pajamas.
"Come with me, little one," he said. "You are about to begin a whole new life of galactic importance."
Leia, Ackbar, Turpin, and the rest of the rescue party swooped through the violet skies of Anoth with Ackbar's B-Wing in the lead. Even though Ackbar had resigned from the Council and secluded himself on his watery homeworld of Calamari after his disastrous crash, he had leapt immediately into action when Leia told him that baby Anakin was in danger. The starfighters soared over the fanged landscape toward the stone turret that Ackbar and Luke had chosen for the base. Leia saw smoke and debris, and the signs of an attack made her blood run cold.
"We're too late," she whispered.
Part of the rock spire had been blasted away, and soot splattered the eroded surface. Below, she saw the still smoldering remains of several mechanical spiders. Setting down in the stronghold's hangar bay, the rescue ships maneuvered around the four walkers that cluttered the landing area. Ackbar, Leia, and Turpin sprang out of their cockpits as other Calamarian fighters joined them. Ackbar assumed command.
"Turpin, go with Minister Leia and half of the fighters directly to the nursery. I will take the other troops down into the lower levels to find Winter. I think I know what her strategy would have been."
Leia yanked out her blaster pistol. With a hardened expression, she took the lead. As Leia's team rounded the last corner toward Anakin's room, Leia swerved to keep from tripping over the slow-moving power droid that plodded along on its rounds, unconcerned with the turmoil.
"Oh, no,"
she said, lurching cautiously to a stop, just as Ambassador Fergan backed out of the nursery, clutching a squalling Anakin to his broad chest. Both Leia and Fergan froze for a moment, staring at each other. The Calamarian rescuers leveled their weapons at Fergan. He held the baby in front of him like a shield.
"Give Anakin back to me,"
Leia said, her voice dripping with greater threat than an entire fleet of Star Destroyers could convey.
"I'm afraid not."
Fergan wrapped a broad hand around Anakin's fragile neck.
"Point your guns away from me, or I'll snap his neck."
He edged along the tunnel.
"Even if you stun me, I can still crush his windpipe. Drop your weapons."
"Back off," Leia ordered her troops, taking a step backward herself. The Calamarian defenders stepped to the side and dropped their weapons, clearing a path for Fergan. All except for Turpin. He stood holding his hands in front of him like sharp claws. Fergin saw the swollen, sagging Calamarian head, the tracery of blunt scars, and suddenly recognized him.
"So, my little fish, you betrayed me after all. I didn't think you had the strength of will."
"I found the strength," Turpin said. He stepped toward Fergin.
In Fergin's grasp, baby Anakin's dark brown eyes flashed as if he were deep in thought. Suddenly, Fergin cried out as he stumbled against the squarish, waddling power droid that had silently crept up behind him. The droid gave out a small jolt of electricity, shocking Fergin. The ambassador tripped and fell, still holding the child. As the Calamarian defenders snatched up their weapons again, Turpin lunged forward to grab the baby out of Fergin's hands. The other Calamarians fired at Fergin, but the squat man rolled across the floor, got to his knees, and launched himself around the corner.
"After him!"
Turpin cried. He passed baby Anakin to Leia and dashed off in pursuit of Fergin. As hot tears flowed from her eyes, Leia hugged her youngest son, trying to console him. She sank to the floor, rocking him back and forth. Turpin raced feverishly, chasing Fergin up sloping corridors. He emerged into the landing grotto to find Fergin already scrambling into one of the unoccupied MT-80s. Turpin snarled and ran to another MT-AT and powered it up just as Fergin's vehicle approached the large opening at the cliff's edge. Akbar and Winter arrived just in time to see the battle between the two spider walkers. Turpin's walker charged ahead, raising its two front legs, and grabbed the metal limbs of Fergin's transport. Fergin's vehicle reached out with its own legs to grasp the edge of the cave opening, trying to haul itself forward and away. Turpin's walker pushed forward and forward. Inside the cockpit of the ambassador's vehicle, Fergin frantically grabbed the controls, but did not seem to know which to use. Turpin shoved Fergin's walker completely through where the blast door had been blown away and held the thrashing MT-AT out over open space. Turpin released his grip. Ambassador Fergin's multi-legged vehicle flailed as it dropped through the air on a long plunge toward the jagged landscape far below. Before the assault vehicle could actually strike the ground, Turpin fired both of his powerful blaster cannons. The beams blew up Fergin's MT-AT with a blinding flash just above the spiked rocks. And then Turpin continued his walker's own forward motion, intent on driving himself over the edge in a suicidal plunge. Turpin had confessed his betrayal to Akbar, so the Admiral instantly guessed what his fellow Calamarian intended, and he lunged for the blast door controls. Just as the thrashing metal legs vanished over the lip of the cliff, Akbar punched the buttons, hoping that the skewed half of the door still functioned just enough. The heavy metal plate crashed down on top of the last footpad of Turpin's spider walker, pinning it to the cliff and preventing it from falling.
"Help him!"
Akbar cried. The other Calamarian scrambled forward, accompanied by the Admiral himself. Secured with a tow cable from one of the B-wings, they lowered themselves over the cliff to open the canopy of Turpin's walker. Inside, they found him shuddering and nearly unconscious with shock. The team rigged a sling and hauled him to the safety of the grotto. Akbar bent over him, looking stern. He called Turpin's name until the scarred Calamarian finally stirred.
You should have let me die, he said. My death should have been my punishment.
No, Turpin. There is still much you can contribute to the New Republic. Still a great many things to do before you will be allowed to give up.
Akbar straightened, realizing that those words could just as well apply to himself after he had run away to hide on the planet Calamari.
Your punishment, Turpin, will be to live.
The Falcon cruised over the lush treetops of Yavin 4, and Han Solo set the ship down in front of the great temple. Leia, newly returned from Anoth, and the twins practically tackled him as they rushed up to greet him.
"Daddy, Daddy!"
Jason and Jaina cried. Leia, cradling Anakin against her chest, gave Han a long kiss.
"Hello there, little guy,"
Han grinned down at Anakin. Then he looked deep into Leia's eyes. "Are you all right? That message you sent wasn't very explicit." "You'll get the whole story when we have some time alone. I'm glad all of our children are home to stay, though. We'll protect them ourselves from now on."
"Sounds great to me."
Han stepped away from the Falcon as he saw Luke striding toward him across the flattened landing grid. R2-D2 puttered along next to him as if reluctant ever to leave his master's side again.
Luke!
Han cried. He ran to give Luke an enthusiastic hug.
Great to see you up and around again. About time you quit napping.
Luke clapped him on the back, but his gaze remained fixed on the Falcon. Han turned to see Kip Duran descending the boarding ramp. Han had brought him to Yavin from Coruscant on the orders of the New Republic Council. They had agreed that only Luke could determine a fitting punishment for Kip. His eyes locked on Luke's, and the two Jedi stared at each other as if psychically linked. Luke walked toward his students slowly, his face betraying neither fury nor vengefulness. I knew you would come back, Kip.
Exarchun is destroyed? Kip asked, but he knew the answer already.
Exarchun will have no influence on your future training, Kip. The question is, what will you do with your abilities?
Kip blinked. You would let me continue my training?
Luke's expression softened further. I had to witness the death of my first teacher. I also had to confront Darth Vader, my own father. I have done other difficult tasks. I did not plan these things, but each time I passed through the fire of an ordeal such as those, I emerged a more powerful Jedi. You, Kip, have been thrown into the flames. I must determine whether you have been consumed or tempered into a great Jedi. Can you forsake the dark side?
I will try.
No!
Luke shouted with the first glimmering of anger that Han had heard in his voice.
There is no try. You must believe you will do it, or you will fail.
The jungle fell silent. Kip's dark eyes glittered as he looked into Luke's face.
I want to be a Jedi, he said.
I really appreciate you taking me, Han,
Lando said, reaching over to slap his friend's shoulder. Once again, the two were flying together in the cockpit of the Millennium Falcon. He knew that Han was not terribly pleased to leave Leia and his children again so soon, even if only for a day, to drop him off at Kessel, where he expected Mara Jade to be waiting. He suspected, too, that Han was also worried about Chewbacca, who had sent no word since advancing with his Maw occupation force into the Black Hole cluster. Since the Maw lay near Kessel, Han probably hoped to learn some news. It'll be worth it, if only to keep you from begging for rides all the time, Han said. When they approached Kessel, Mara answered their call and flew out to escort them down to Kessel's garrison moon. Mara's space yacht neared the Falcon, then spun around to dart back toward the moon. Lando sat up sharply.
Hey, that's my ship. That's the Lady Luck.
Well, Han said, at least that saves us the trouble of looking for it. The two ships entered the cave mouth of the moon garrison, flying past the thick blast doors into the garish light of a large landing bay. The Falcon coasted in and landed in a broad, polished area beside the Lady Luck. Mara Jade swung out, her helmet tucked under her elbow. She tossed her head to loosen her dark reddish-brown hair. Lando stared, awed by the energy and intelligence she radiated.
Hey, Mara, Han said. Where'd you find Lando's ship?
Right where Lando claims he landed it. Seems nobody had time to strip her down and remove the identification markings. Lando glanced around the garrison bay, but all the ships looked unfamiliar. They weren't the barely moving scrap heaps that had comprised the fleet of the unscrupulous Morath Duel, the Rybet who had run Kessel's black market glitter stim operation. Along with markings unique to each vessel, each ship carried a subtle cross-hatched design on the wing. Mara noticed Lando's inspection.
That's our new insignia for the Smugglers' Alliance, she said.
What happened to all of Duel's ships? Lando asked.
90% of Duel's ships were obliterated in their tangle with Dala's Star Destroyers. Most of the surviving pirates fled into hyperspace.
Lando let his hopes rise.
So what you're saying is that Kessel is deserted, ready for the taking?
Yes. I've talked over your proposal with some members of our alliance, and it sounds good to us. Not only have you proven your ability in your other ventures, but you've also got strong connections with the New Republic, which will allow efficient distribution channels for Glitterstim. You've even got enough money to invest in the new infrastructure. She shrugged. Sounds like a good deal all around.
Lando beamed.
I knew you'd realize that being partners with me is a very good deal. Should we go down and have a look at the real estate?
Kessel's surface had suffered a lot of damage under Dalla's pounding, but Lando consoled himself with his pleasure in retaking the Lady Luck's pilot seat and by calculating the unclaimed wealth within the tunnels below. But Mara Jade frowned as she looked out the viewport.
There is one problem, Calrissian. You see, Morath Duel has holed himself up inside the prison building. All of his cohorts have fled or been killed, and now he's using the sophisticated prison defense systems to keep everyone else out.
I wish you had mentioned that detail a little sooner, Lando said.
The battered Star Destroyer Gorgon barely survived its passage into the Maw Cluster. Many of the Gorgon's stabilizers had blown in their narrow escape from the multiple supernova explosion in the Cauldron Nebula. Outer layers of armor had boiled away, but Dalla had taken a gamble. Dalla had ordered the Gorgon to plunge blindly into hyperspace mere moments before the explosive front had reached her rear thrusters. The desperate leap knocked them headlong on a reckless course through the hazards of the universe. The Gorgon had emerged in an uninhabited void in the outer rim. Their shields had failed, life support systems were partly burned out, and the hull had been breached in several areas. Collectively gasping from their narrow escape, Dalla's crew had set about effecting repairs. One of the engines was permanently damaged, and three of the aft turbolaser batteries were dead, but Dalla had let none of her crew rest until the Gorgon was functional again. Now Admiral Dalla clung to her command chair and kept her eyes open against the blazing swirls from the inferno of trapped gases. The Gorgon followed a convoluted path through the barrier of black holes. Suddenly the colors washed away from the front viewport like a blindfold being ripped from her eyes. The Star Destroyer had stumbled into the calm at the center of the cluster. She recognized the isolated clump of interconnected planetoids that was Maw Installation. Glittering lights showed that the facility still functioned, but she also saw that the framework of the Death Star prototype was gone, and in its place she saw a Rebel frigate and three Corellian corvettes.
"Admiral," said Kratos, her second in command. "I see, Commander. It appears we have some work to do."
Kip Duran ducked under a thorny vine as a flock of scarlet insect birds thrummed into the air. Stinging thistles brushed against his arm, his face. Overhead the branches rustled as arboreal creatures fled from the noise. Sweat dripped from Kip's dark hair, and the oppressive air felt like a moist blanket. He did his best to keep up with Master Skywalker, who flowed through the jungle thickets finding secret paths. Kip had once used dark tricks to find the easiest routes through the underbrush. Now, though, even the thought of such techniques made him shudder. Now Kip was intimidated by the man he had defeated through Exar Kun's evil powers. Master Skywalker had insisted that Kip arm himself, that he wear the lightsaber built by Gantoris. Did Luke intend to challenge Kip to a duel? A duel to the death this time? If so, then Kip vowed not to fight. He had allowed his anger to cause too much destruction already. Unable to bear his feelings of isolation and loneliness, Kip tried to keep the Jedi teacher talking. "Master Skywalker, what if I fail to distinguish between the dark side and the light side? I'm afraid that any power I use now might also lead me down the path of destruction." "The dark side is easier, faster, more seductive," Master Skywalker said. "But you can identify it by your own emotions. If you use your power for enlightenment to help others, it may be from the light side. But if you use it for your own advancement out of anger or revenge, then the power is tainted. Don't use it. You will know when you are calm, passive." Kip listened and knew that he had done everything wrong. Exar Kun had given him false information. The Jedi Master turned to him. "Do you understand?" Master Skywalker asked.
"Yes."
"Good." Master Skywalker parted the branches on the other side of the clearing to expose a sight that made Kip stop cold in his tracks. The vegetation dropped off at the edge of a glassy, smooth lake, a circular pond that reflected the cloudless skies above like a pool of quicksilver. In the center of the pond sat an island of volcanic rock.
on which perched a sharply angled split pyramid made of obsidian. Two halves of the steep pyramid had been spread apart to bracket the polished black statue, a towering colossus of a man with flowing hair, bulky uniform, and a long black cape. Kip knew the image all too well. Exarchine in life. Inside that temple, Kip had received his initiation into the Sith teachings, while Dorskitty One had lain in an unnatural coma against the wall. "The dark side is strong in that place," Kip said. "I can't go in there." Master Skywalker said, "In your fear lies caution, and in that caution lies wisdom and strength." He squatted on a comfortable rock at the edge of the crystalline lake. "I will wait here, but you must go inside." Kip swallowed, terror and revulsion rising within him. This black temple symbolized everything that had rotted his core, everything that had led him astray, all the mistakes he had made. "What will I find in there?"
"Ask no more questions. I can give you no answers. You must choose whether to carry your weapon with you." He nodded toward the lightsaber clipped to Kip's waist. "You will have only what you bring with you." Trembling, Kip went to the water's edge. He looked down at the tall columns of stone that stopped just beneath the surface of the water, providing stepping stones. Tentatively, he set one foot on the first stone. The water rippled around his foot. He drew a deep breath, raised his head high. He did not look back at Master Skywalker. Once inside the temple, it seemed to breathe a cool air current that seeped in and out of the space. The walls glittered with an inner light that had been trapped within the volcanic glass. Tracings of frost spiraled in a frozen dance up and down the walls. In the far corner, a cistern dripped, filled with chilled water. He waited. Suddenly, Kip's stomach wrenched. A shadow rose from the black wall, an ominous form, human-shaped. It gained power, growing as Kip fed it with his fear. The figure rose higher, a featureless silhouette that nevertheless seemed familiar to Kip.
You're dead!
Kip had tried to sound angry and defiant, but his voice betrayed him.
Yes, I am dead, but still I live within you. Only you, Kip, can make my memory strong.
No, I'll destroy you.
In his hand, Kip felt the black power crackling, the ebony lightning he had used to strike Master Skywalker, the power of fanged serpents, the dark teachings of the Sith. How ironic it would be to use Exarchine's own power against him. The energy grew stronger, begging to be unleashed, demanding that he give himself over to it so he could eradicate the black shadow for all time. But Kip forced himself to stop. This was not the way. The black Sith power faded from his fingertips. The shadow waited, but still Kip forced his power back, smothered his anger. Anger was exactly what Exarchune would want. Kip could not give in to it now. Instead, he pulled his lightsaber free and flicked it on. The violet-white blade shone with purest light. The shadow hovered as if waiting to do battle with him, waiting for Kip to make the first move. It lifted its nebulous arms, blacker than anything Kip had seen before. Kip raised Gantoris's lightsaber to strike, proud of what he was about to do. He would use a Jedi weapon instead, a weapon of light to strike the darkness. He made ready to swing. The shadow hung poised as if stunned, and Kip halted again. He could not strike out, not even with a lightsaber. If he attacked Exarchune, he would still be succumbing to the temptation and ease of violence, regardless of the weapon he chose. Kip switched the lightsaber off and clipped the handle to his belt. He stood alone, face to face with the shadow that now seemed his own size, merely the black outline of a human wearing a shroud. "I will not fight you," Kip said. "I am glad," said the voice, which became clearer now, more maddeningly familiar, not Exarchian at all, it never had been. The shadowy arms reached up to pull back the cowl, exposing a luminous face that clearly belonged to Kip's brother, Zeth. "I am dead," the image of Zeth said, But only you can keep my memory strong. Thank you for freeing me, brother. The image of Zeth embraced Kip with a brief, tingling rustle of warmth that melted the ice in Kip's spine. Then the spirit vanished, and Kip found himself alone again in a musty, empty temple that no longer held any power over him. Kip stepped into the warm sunlight again, free of the shadows. On the opposite shore, he saw Master Skywalker stand up and look at him. Luke grinned, and he opened his arms in a celebratory gesture. Master Skywalker's voice echoed across the flat surface of the still water.
Come back and join us, Kip. Welcome home, Jedi Knight.
The immense barricade doors of the Imperial Correction Facility did not budge, nor did they open when Hand knocked. Naturally. He stood with Lando and Mara Jade on the scoured landscape of Kessel, dressed in an insulated jumpsuit taken from the Lady Luck stores. Mara leaned closer to Han, her shout muffled through a breath mask that filtered out the planet's toxic air.
We could bring down a full-scale assault team from the moon. We have enough firepower.
Lando shouted.
No, there must be a way to get in without damaging my facility.
The cold, dry wind stung Han's eyes, and he turned his head to protect them from the breeze. He remembered gasping for air when Skinksnecks, Morth Duel's henchmen, had dragged him and Chewbacca into the spice mines without giving them breathing apparatus. Right now, Han wanted nothing more than to kick the toad-like Duel out of the prison so that his frog eyes could blink and his fat lips pump together as he tried to fill his lungs. Duel, an administrator of the correction facility, had dealt in black market glitter stim, making deals with Han and other smugglers to deliver the precious cargo to gangsters such as Jabba the Hutt. But Duel had a habit of delivering his partners into Imperial hands whenever it proved convenient. Duel had ratted on Han long ago, forcing him to dump his cargo, which had made Jabba very angry.
I've got a better idea, Mara said, interrupting Han's thoughts.
She craned her neck to look up at the murky sky.
Up on the garrison moon, I brought along Ghent, our slicer. He can crack into anything.
Okay, bring him down along with the Falcon, Han said. An hour later, Han saw the pronged disc of the Millennium Falcon land beside the Lady Luck. The ramp slid out, and five smugglers emerged. Two tall, well-muscled women, Mistral guards, a hairy, tusk-faced whippid, and a reptilian Trandoshan. Their bulging belts contained enough recharge packs for an entire assault. Last down the ramp, still fumbling to adjust a breath mask over his face, came Ghent, the slicer, with tousled hair and alert eyes. He fixed his attention on the barricade gates.
Should be a piece of cake, Ghent said.
Hans said, I certainly never dreamed I'd be trying so hard to break into the Kessel prison.
Cowering behind a locked door in the lower levels of the Imperial Correction Facility, Morth Duel longed for the good old days. Years ago, after he had taken over the prison, Duel had moved into the warden's office, where he spent time staring out at the landscape, observing the desolate purity of the alkali wastelands. He had fed upon tender flying insects. Whenever the whim struck him, he had mated with one of his captive female ribets in his personal harem. Now, though, since Dala's attack, he had moved into one of the high-security prison cells for protection. He tapped the mechanical eye that helped him to focus. The device had broken during the space battle around Kessel. Duel had tinkered with the mechanical components, putting its gears and lenses back together. It no longer worked properly, though, and his vision winked out from time to time. Duel paced the cold stone floor of his cell. Even the larvae that Duel had locked inside pitch-black rooms to process the glitter stim were growing restless. The larvae were his own ungrateful children, immature ribets who had not yet undergone their final metamorphosis. Blind and worm-like, almost as large as Duel himself, the larvae were perfect workers to wrap the spice fibers in opaque sheaths, since even brief exposure to light would spoil the product. A few larvae had gotten loose, fleeing blindly through the winding prison passages, hiding in shadowy cells, waiting in darkened wings to ambush Duel. To make things worse, one of the largest male larvae had freed all of Duel's specially picked females. The females had fled into the labyrinth of the prison so that during this time of greatest terror, Duel couldn't even relieve his tension with an occasional visit to the harem. He had no choice but to remain locked inside his cell. He had blasted an escape passage into the spice mines directly under the prison. Duel could lose himself for a long time in that network, but he still couldn't get off planet. And lately the tunnels had become a far more dangerous place. After Dala's attack, most of the spice miners had fled, and the spiders had surged upward to lay down their glitterstim webs along the walls. Looking with specially adapted kinetic energy detectors, Duel had spotted swarms of the monsters in the deepest shafts, migrating closer to the surface. In despair, Duel sat on his bunk and stared at the monitors. He was astonished to see a ship land outside, and even though all humans looked alike, Duel was certain he recognized one of the three intruders pummeling his armored door. Han Solo, the man he hated most in the entire universe. By the time he heard the gate split apart a few moments later, Duel had come to the conclusion that he must trust his own children, the larvae. Duel rushed down the corridors, gathering weapons from the prison's armory. When he opened the protective vaults, the larvae reared back like caterpillars, blind eyes bulging as they attempted to sense the identity of the intruder.
"It's only me," Duel said.
Duel herded the oldest and strongest of the larvae along ramps to the lower levels. He would station them as guardians inside his cell. Being blind, they probably couldn't hit anything with the blasters, but he hoped they would at least fire with enthusiasm once he gave them the orders. He was startled by a high-pitched scream echoing from three of the nearby chambers. Several of the freed female Rybets sprang out, wailing and throwing sharp objects at Duel and his team. A drinking mug struck him on the soft side of his head. He dropped one of the satchels and ran wildly down the corridor, waving his sucker-tipped hands. Most of the larvae followed him, but a few split off to stay with their mothers. Finally, slamming the thick door of his cell behind him, he emptied his remaining satchel and placed fully charged blasters in the hands of six potential defenders.
"Just point it toward whatever noise you hear. When they break in, it's up to you to shoot. This is the firing button."
The smooth-skinned creatures shivered and ran their sensitive mouth tendrils over the barrels of the weapons. Without warning, the vision in his mechanical eye flickered. And Duel couldn't see a thing. He moaned in terror. By tapping into the prison surveillance cameras, Mara Jade was able to locate Duel barricaded in one of the dungeons. Han watched as the two Mistral guards placed concussion detonators around the seal on the door of Duel's cell. They ducked their heads and covered their ears as the concussion detonators exploded. They heard a volley of sudden blaster fire from inside the sealed chamber.
"No, no, not yet!"
came a howling voice that Han recognized as Morath Duel's. The last concussion detonator blew the bottom off the door. The hairy Whippid rushed forward to elbow the heavy plates aside.
"Look out!" Mara called.
The Whippid ducked and rolled as the soft larvae flailed, pointing their blasters and firing in every direction.
"Get them!"
Duel yelled. The larvae whirled at the sound of his voice and fired their blasters toward Duel himself, but he had already ducked behind a thick piece of wall plating.
"Not at me!"
Hissing, the reptilian Trandoshan shot inside, cutting down two of the larvae. Han took out another of the larvae just as the ceiling collapsed in flaming chunks. Wailing for revenge, swarms of female Rybets dropped through the ceiling into Duel's private cell. Each bore a blaster of her own and fired repeatedly at the metal shield Duel hid behind, until its center glowed a cherry red. The larvae targeted on the new noise, but then, as if suddenly they understood, as if they could communicate with their own mothers, the larvae turned and directed their fire toward Duel as well.
"Stop! Stop!"
Duel cried. He yelped and dropped the superheated protective shield. His mechanical eye popped off and broke into a thousand bouncing and rattling components on the floor. His long, squishy fingers punched a hidden control button, and a trap door opened beneath him. With a squeal, Duel leapt through an access hatch into the escape tunnel, down into the cold, black mines.
"Hurry before he gets away," Lando said. "I don't want him running around in my spice mines."
Han rushed toward the trap door and dropped to his knees, pushing his face into the darkness. He heard Duel splatting footsteps diminishing as he ran on webbed feet deeper into the catacombs. Then Han heard a new sound that turned his blood cold. The energy spiders.
Pan's skin crawled. At the tail end of a high-pitched and gut-wrenching scream, Duel's footsteps suddenly stopped. The scream cut off abruptly, as did the sound of running ice-pick feet. The instant silence seemed even more horrible than the scream, and Han quickly pulled up the trapdoor and secured it before the energy spiders could seek other prey.
"Well, Lando," he said, "now you can start remodeling."
Han, Lando, and Mara rode back up to the Garrison Moon in the Falcon. Mara spent most of her time reassuring Lando that the Lady Luck would be just fine behind the security fields of the reoccupied prison. Lando didn't seem to believe her entirely, but he did not want to disagree with Mara Jade.
"We've got a lot of paperwork to do," Mara said. "I have all the standard contracts and agreements up at the moon base."
Suddenly an alert flashed on their communications panel.
"Warning! We've detected a large vessel approaching Kessel, and I mean large."
Lando's eyes were as big as viewports. "Not just large," he said. Then they all saw the globe-shaped object through the viewport. Spherical but skeletal, cross-braced and arched with giant girders, the size of a miniature moon. It's the Death Star!
"It's a rebel base,"
Tal Sivrin said, looking at the streaked atmosphere fuzzing around Kessel and its close-orbiting moon.
"No doubt about it. Look at those ships. We need to test this Death Star, right? We've got a handy target right here."
Doxin grinned.
"I never thought I'd get the chance to see this weapon in action."
"It's never been calibrated, you know,"
Golanda said with a sour expression.
"It's a planet-destroying superlaser,"
Doxin shot back.
"We could turn that whole world into rubble. How well does it need to be calibrated?"
Out the front viewport, the green superlaser beam lanced out of the Death Star in an immense blast, greater in diameter than a starship. Its target erupted in a blaze of smoke, fire, and incandescent rubble. Tal Sivrin applauded. Doxin let out a cry of triumph and amazement.
"You missed," Golanda said.
Tal Sivrin blinked his small dark eyes.
"What? You hit the moon, not the planet?" "The target was irrelevant,"
Tal Sivrin said.
"At least now we know the prototype is fully functional."
He nodded approvingly.
"Now we can put this weapon to use."
Leia was amazed that Mon Mothma still clung to life. Anxiously, she stood over the deathbed of the chief of state, looking at the medical apparatus and life support systems that refused to let Mon Mothma die. Terpfin had explained the source of Mon Mothma's illness. Ambassador Fergan, who, during what was ostensibly a diplomatic mission to Coruscant, had tossed a drink into Mon Mothma's face, a drink spiked with poison. The poison, composed of artificially created viruses called nano-destroyers, was dismantling Mon Mothma's cells, one nucleus at a time. There was no antidote. The auburn-haired woman had once been a fiery rival of Leia's father on the Senate floor. Now she could no longer stand on her feet. Her skin was gray and translucent, thin as crumpled parchment on a framework of bones. It took her eyes a long time to focus on her visitor. Leia swallowed. Feeling hot lead in her stomach, she reached out with trembling fingers to touch Mon Mothma's arm. Mon Mothma whispered,
"Leia, you came."
"I came because you asked me to."
Han had dropped her and the children off on Coruscant, grumbling about having to go away again with Lando, but promising to return in only a few days. She would believe that when it happened. In the meantime, Leia was shocked to see the accelerating decline of Mon Mothma's condition.
"Your children are safe now?"
"Yes, Winter is staying here to protect them. I won't let them be taken from me again."
Leia would be even busier than before. She would see less of Han, less of her children. For a moment she envied the peaceful life of a lower functionary who could leave work at the end of the day and go home, letting unfinished tasks wait for tomorrow. But she had been born a Jedi and raised by Senator Bail Organa. Her life had been focused toward a greater destiny, and she could not shirk either her public or her private burden.
She took a deep breath, tasting the nauseating chemicals that clung to the air, the disinfectants, the medicines, the ozone smell of atmospheric sterilizers. She felt so helpless. Her excitement at defeating the Imperial Strike Force and rescuing her son seemed trivial in the face of Mon Mothma's battle against the slow-acting poison. Leia took little consolation in knowing that Ambassador Fergan was no longer alive to gloat.
Leia, I have tendered my resignation to the Council. I will no longer serve as Chief of State.
Leia realized that empty encouragements would be useless. She reacted in a way that Mon Mothma had taught her to respond, thinking of the New Republic first.
What about the government? Won't the Council bicker with each other and accomplish nothing? Who will they look to for leadership?
She looked down at Mon Mothma, and the haggard woman regarded her with shining, hopeful eyes.
You will be our leader, Leia.
Leia blinked in shock and opened her mouth. Mon Mothma found the strength to nod slightly.
Yes, Leia. While you were away, the Council met to discuss our future. My resignation is no surprise to anyone, and we voted unanimously that you should be my replacement.
Speechless, Leia knelt at Mon Mothma's bedside for a long time, far into Coruscant's night.